Hello, I'm Ala Jones and welcome to the CAV podcast. You're listening to episode 16 of the CAV podcast, brought to you by the Central Association of Agricultural Valuers. This is our first podcast of 2021, where we're going to be tackling the topic of telecoms. Now, the world of telecoms masts in the UK continues to be contentious. But in December 2020, the Upper Tribunal published its decision in a case concerning the renewal of a rural mast agreement, which has sent some clear messages on how these matters should be addressed. Here to explain that decision to us is Kate Russell of the CAV. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks, Aled.
So, is this the case that everyone in the rural world has been waiting for?
Well, I think it probably is, Aled, yes. It's the first case to look at whether a renewal agreement for an existing rural mast site should be imposed on the landowner, and where it hasn't been possible to agree terms between the parties, what those terms should be, including, of course, terms for payment. Renewals of already existing leases have really proved to be the biggest area of contention in telecoms. The idea behind the new electronic communications code was to support rollout of new sites and the upgrading needed for 5G and all about the enhanced infrastructure we were going to require for better connectivity. But we've actually seen relatively few new masts so far, other than some for the emergency services network. And there hasn't been much upgrading yet in rural areas, although it'll be with us eventually. So renewals for existing sites has really been the main focus for operators. And this is the first case to look at that in detail for a rural site.
And would you say that this was a fairly typical rural mast site?
Yes, I think so. From the description that we've got in the tribunal decision, it sounds like a fairly typical setup. It was a ground-mounted tower site. It was set in a bit of woodland in the middle of the Dale Park estate in West Sussex, within the South Downs National Park. The site was some way off the public road, reached by a private access track. There were a couple of houses fairly close by, both of them occupied by people connected to the estate. So it's a sort of not untypical setup. The original agreement dated from 1999, when the site was leased to what used to be Arqiva. Arqiva has recently sold its UK mast portfolio to Cellnex, a Spanish telecoms business, and they're using the brand name OnTower. So the tenant of the site is now OnTower, and the name of the case is OnTower versus Green. OnTower is an infrastructure provider. So it doesn't run a communications network itself. It provides the towers and the infrastructure on which other operators can attach their equipment and apparatus. So making its apparatus available for use by other operators who pay a market value for the use, that's essential to OnTower's business model, as we'll see later on as we discuss this case. Now, in 2019, the original lease expired. It had been contracted out of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. So the operator was able to seek a renewal agreement under paragraph 33 of the code. And that distinguishes it from cases like Ashlock and Hanover, where the original agreements were protected by the 54 Act and needed to go down a different route. And in this case, the parties were able to get most of their terms agreed, but they disagreed on three key points. And so they ended up before the Upper Tribunal.
I'm guessing that one of the points they couldn't agree on was payment. What were the others?
Yes, payment was one of the outstanding issues. We'll come to that last. The others concern the rights to install and upgrade equipment and rights to share the apparatus with other operators. So OnTower wanted unrestricted rights to install and upgrade the equipment, but the landowner wanted to restrict those rights in line with paragraph 17 of the code. That permits upgrading, provided that it doesn't cause more than a minimal impact on the appearance of the site and it causes no additional burden to the site provider. Now, on this site, it's likely that an upgrade was going to be needed within 5 years to enable 5G, but at the time of the discussions, the operator couldn't give any indication of what that upgrade would look like, whether it might cause additional visual intrusion. So there was quite a degree of uncertainty for the landowner around that. Rights to install and upgrade are code rights under paragraph 3 of the code. So the public interest test in paragraph 21 applies. And having looked at the evidence, the Upper Tribunal decided that the public interest in the operator's use of this site overrides the landowner's concerns. And so it chose to impose the rights that the operator sought for installing and upgrading, and noting that the impact of that on the landowner could be compensated for by money.
Earlier you said that sharing the apparatus was essential to this operator. So how did the tribunal deal with that issue?
Yes, OnTower's business model is based on providing access to its towers for mobile network operators. So from their point of view, unrestricted rights to share the apparatus are vital. But importantly, the right to share isn't one of the code rights set out in paragraph 3, unlike the rights to install and upgrade. So the tribunal looked at this issue separately. Firstly, it considered why OnTower needed unrestricted sharing rights in the light of its business purposes and the public interest. And then it considered the concerns raised by the landowner and whether the rights that the operator was seeking should be limited or qualified in any way to try and minimise loss or damage to the landowner. And then finally, it considered whether there were other reasons why the rights that OnTower wanted should be restricted in any way. So having gone through that analysis and looked at each of those parts, the tribunal found that unrestricted sharing was essential to OnTower, and the landowner's concerns in relation to that issue were not really reflected in reality or based on evidence. So there were concerns, but they weren't very significant. On a rural site, you know, the additional impact of sharing might not be as significant as it would be on a rooftop, for example, when you've got multiple lots of people coming through a building in order to access the roof, quite a degree of disturbance there. So the tribunal didn't find any reason why it needed to moderate the essential rights that OnTower sought, and so it awarded unrestricted sharing in this case.
So it sounds as though the fact that OnTower is an infrastructure provider was central to the tribunal's thinking.
Absolutely, yes. And it's a point just worth dwelling on for a minute, Aled. An infrastructure provider can't fulfil its business purpose unless it has wide rights to share the apparatus. You know, it's fundamental. That's what it's there for. But where the tenant is a network operator, like a Vodafone or somebody like that, it might well be able to fulfil its purpose perfectly well without sharing with others. And we saw this in CTIL versus London and Quadrant Housing, which was a case decided in October, where the tribunal limited the right to share to just two operators, where CTIL was the tenant. And CTIL, of course, is a joint venture of two operators, Vodafone and Telefonica. So it can fulfil its business purpose if both of its operators can use the common apparatus. So this is very much about looking at who is the tenant and what are their business purposes. So if it's a single individual network operator, they might not be able to justify very much sharing. Where it's an infrastructure provider, like OnTower, it's core and essential to its business model.
Right. So with those matters decided, is this where we talk about money?
It is, yes. Now, as you'd expect, both sides presented detailed evidence to support their positions, but they were a long way apart. OnTower was arguing for a rent of £500 a year, and the landowner said the site was worth £7,000 a year, and it was already being leased at just over £6,000. The tribunal adopted the same three-stage approach to rental value, which it's used in two earlier cases, Vodafone versus Hanover Capital and CTIL and London and Quadrant Housing. This approach takes into account the particular characteristics of the site. And this is a really important point, Aled. Landowners and their advisors can now be using this three-stage approach to build the rental figures for their sites by carefully assessing the benefits and the burdens that will be imposed by the particular agreement. They'll need to back up their figures with evidence, and the better the evidence, you know, the more reliable it will be. But it's a really useful framework to base that assessment on.
Okay, so talk us through the three stages.
Right. Stage one is to assess any alternative use value of the site. In this case, it was a small woodland site in the middle of a rural estate. So the alternative use value was agreed by both parties to be a nominal £100 per year. There wasn't really much else you could have used it for other than informal recreation. But other sites in different locations will have all sorts of different prospects for more valuable alternative use. And if you've got a telecom site in a yard, it might be suitable for outdoor storage or used as a parking space for an HGV, for example. And in those cases, the figure for this stage one of the assessment might be higher. Where a landlord thinks that is the case, they're going to need to provide the evidence to prove it. So stage two is to consider the additional benefits that the agreement gives to the tenant over and above the alternative use value. And in this case, the tribunal decided that those benefits to the tenant included the right to keep the existing mast on the site, the right to maintain connections to an electricity supply, a right to enter the landlord's adjoining property to carry out works, you know, looking at the compound fence from the other side or whatever that might be, the tenant's right to a rolling break clause after 5 years. It's quite a common term in telecoms agreements, and it's obviously a real benefit to a tenant to have that option to break. And finally, the right to carry out pruning or trimming of the landlord's trees, particularly relevant in this case because it was a woodland edge site. The parties disagreed about how to value those benefits. OnTower suggested they were worth about £350 a year. The landlord was arguing for £1,300 a year. I don't think the tribunal found either side's evidence particularly compelling, and it came down at a figure of £600 a year, which you might say is coming somewhere between the two. And I think there's another lesson there, Aled, about the importance that the tribunal will attach to reliable evidence. In this whole exercise, the tribunal was looking for the evidence in which it could have confidence to rely on the figures. So then we come to stage three, which is to consider the adverse effects of the agreement on the landlord. And it's perhaps the hardest part to quantify because it's necessarily pretty subjective, really. In this case, the tribunal accepted the landowner's argument that third-party access to the heart of a rural estate was disruptive, and that having given unrestricted rights to share, that impact was likely to be greater than it would otherwise be. You're going to have basically more firms of contractors turning up in their vans. The tribunal acknowledged that those rights of access could widen the scope for potential conflict between OnTower and its contractors on the one hand, those who live and worked on the estate on the other. And that was an additional adverse impact for which the landowner should be paid. So that's compensating in money for that unrestricted right to share. Now, another key concern of the landowner was the potential impact of the upgrade. That might result in a taller mast, it might result in more equipment. There was likely to be more disturbance while the upgrading works were being carried out. And the tribunal recognised the perceived risk to what it referred to as the historic amenity of this rural estate within a national park. But it had already said it felt that those concerns could be adequately addressed by money as well. So taking those two concerns into account, plus the impact of the occasional use of a generator on site, the tribunal awarded a figure of £500 per year to reflect all of those stage three issues. And again, it hadn't really felt able to rely very much on the evidence put forward by the parties on those points. But, you know, as a valuer, you can see that it would be a challenge to provide robust figures to prove it.
Yeah, I can see that. So the main message from the tribunal here is that every site needs to be assessed individually, looking specifically at those three steps you outlined. And this is not going to end up as a rate card approach, will it?
Yeah, that's exactly what the tribunal said. You know, you must look at the individual site and the individual impacts. And it gave some clues as to other adverse effects that might be relevant in other cases. For example, it noted that here, there was no claim by the landowner for any loss in rental value for the houses that were closest to the mast. And there were two houses within 40 metres on this site, so pretty close. Now, in that case, it might have been because they were occupied by people closely connected to the estate, so there wasn't a loss in rental value to be accounted for. But if they'd been let on the open market and the landlord had been able to prove evidence to show that the rent was below market value because of the presence of the mast, that would have been another legitimate point for a landowner to include in stage three. So the landowner's got to look at all the factors that arise from the telecoms agreement, define them, try to quantify the financial impact with evidence to support the figures where it's available, and that's how they'll work up their figure for the three-stage assessment.
And in the end, what was the total value of the site at Dale Park?
Well, the stage one assessment was found to be worth £100 a year. Stage two resulted in £600 a year, and stage three, another £500 per year. So the total for this site was £1,200 per year. And the tribunal then checked that figure against the comparable evidence that the experts had presented and found that it sat comfortably against a figure of £2,500 a year agreed consensually for a similar site, because it made the point that consensual agreements had often been shown to include an element of incentive payment to avoid the cost and the risk and the delay of legal proceedings. And on that basis, the tribunal suggested that consensual rents might be twice as high as those imposed by the tribunal. However, it also again stressed the importance of assessing each site individually. And it commented that a site that didn't suffer the same burdens as this one, perhaps where there were no houses nearby or there was no shared access, they might only be worth a payment of about £750 a year, depending on the evidence presented. So, you know, it's all about the individual assessment of the case.
This is a pretty disappointing result for landlords, isn't it? Bearing in mind that it's a substantial drop from previous rent levels.
Well, it is a very substantial drop for this site, which was let at more than £6,000 a year and had been since 1999. That presumably the rent had varied over time, but the government has said that part of the reason for reforming the code was in order to reduce costs to operators, including rental costs, because there needs to be much more investment in our digital connectivity as a country. And that investment is going to be made by the private sector. The private sector will demand a return. I think most landlords understand the principle that rents have got to come down to help pay for better connectivity. And after all, many rural areas, you know, stand to benefit considerably from better connectivity in all kinds of ways. When you think about what, you know, how we're all relying on digital connectivity now as we're recording this during another period of pandemic lockdown. But having said that, it's still difficult for some landowners to understand why it is that their site was worth, you know, £5,000 or £6,000 for many years, and now it's suddenly worth much less. Especially when a tenant like OnTower is going to be charging multiple operators rather more than £1,200 a year to use the site. But if we put this in perspective a bit, cast your mind back 2 years and remember what operators were offering when the new code first came in. We were seeing nominal sums of less than £100 being offered for the whole of a 10 or 15 year term. And the cases that we've seen come through the tribunal in the past 12 months have established that rents are not to be nominal sums, must reflect the impact of the agreement on the particular site. And in that context, perhaps £1,200 a year for a small woodland site of about 67 square metres doesn't represent too bad a result. Of course, as we've already said, a different site may be worth a different sum if it has different burdens. And don't forget the tribunal's point that a consensually agreed rent might be worth twice what is imposed by the tribunal once the incentive element's included.
Are there any other messages that we should take from this?
Yes, I think it's important for landowners to remember that if they're negotiating a consensual agreement, they need to reserve the right to make future claims for compensation. There's no statutory right to do that at a later date if you've done a consensual agreement, although there is where the agreement is imposed by the tribunal, as it was in Dale Park. So if at the time you're negotiating the agreement, there's no evidence of loss, a clause that gives the right to make a future claim will reassure the landowner and it will protect their position. And it is the sort of thing that can help an agreement get over the line, because it will allay the landowner's fears that they're going to suffer losses later on for which they're not going to be adequately compensated. So really important to get that express agreement that there will be a right to make a future compensation claim.
So there's plenty in this decision for advisors to take on board, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Those who want to look at it in a bit more detail, if they're CAV members, they can go onto our website and look at our website note. And anyone can look at the full tribunal decision that's available on the tribunal service website. The name of the case is On Tower versus Green. And just to wrap this up, speaking for the CAV as a professional body, I should, of course, make the point that this remains a pretty fraught and complicated area. So anyone involved in a telecoms case should take advice from a suitably experienced valuer whose job it is to help the parties reach a suitable agreement that works for both sides. Where that proves difficult to reach that agreement, always remember alternative dispute resolution is available. It could help to resolve matters without the risk and the expense of going to tribunal. And the CAV has been doing a lot of work on dispute resolution recently. But Aled, I think that's a topic of its own for a podcast on another day.
Yes, indeed. Dispute resolution is a topic for another podcast, if not a series of podcasts. But as you referred to there, Kate, I think it is worth mentioning that the CAV has recently launched its Facilitating Dispute Resolution service. It's a service to the whole rural economy, providing arbitration, mediation, expert determination and other means to resolve disputes from partnerships and contracts to compulsory purchase compensation. This follows, of course, the Agriculture Act taking effect, which gives the president of the CAV the power as a professional authority to appoint arbitrators to determine disputes under the 86 and 95 Act tenancies. As always, more information can be found on the CAV website, caav.org.uk. Kate, once again, thank you for bringing us right up to date in the world of telecoms. Your analysis is always incredibly helpful and practical. Thank you.
Thanks, Aled.
And there we are. We've reached the end of episode 16. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, then please hit subscribe on whichever platform you use. So until the next time, on behalf of Kate Russell and myself, Aled Jones, thank you for listening and bye for now.